Welcome to Global Leader Radio, sponsored by the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University, discussing ideas that matter with people who care. Now here's your host, Director of Business Development and Instructor of Management for the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University, Alvin Miles.
Happy Monday and welcome to another information-packed edition of Global Leader Radio. Today, I'm both humbled and honored to introduce to you two people with a wealth of global work experience, as they both have seen global leadership in action, as well as being leaders on a global scale themselves. You know, interestingly enough, if I were to look in the dictionary under global, there's a strong possibility the faces of these two gentlemen would just might pop up. So I'm proud to introduce Scott Ellison, CEO of East West Manufacturing, an Atlanta-based offshore manufacturing and supply chain management company, and Dr. Govind Hariharan, Executive Director of the India-China-America Institute and former chair of the Department of Economics, Finance, and Quantitative Analysis at the Coles College of Business at Kennesaw State University in Atlanta, Georgia. Hello to both of you.
Hello.
Hello.
Well, good stuff. Well, gentlemen, again, it is an honor and a pleasure, and I'm looking forward to having a nice conversation with both of you and invite a few hundred thousand of our closest friends to listen in as we talk through this. So, again, Scott, we'll start with you. So, from the bio, I understand you were born and raised in Wisconsin.
That's right.
So, does that mean you're a cheesehead?
I am a cheesehead.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. And you're a cheese in my veins.
A cheesehead in Falcon Land.
Yep.
Oh, okay. All right. And you also.
Although I've been here since 1995, so I don't know at what point I become an Atlantinian, I'm still, you know, it goes way back to Wisconsin.
Well, good. Take us back. Give us a feel for Scott Ellison from a personal perspective.
Well, I grew up outside of Milwaukee, about 30 minutes outside of the city on a lake called Pewaukee Lake. It's a sailing lake. So they used to call me, when I was a kid, I was called the meat, because that's when it would be a windy day on a Saturday or Sunday, I'd get a phone call at 6 a.m. because I'd have to act as meat on the sailboats.
Wow.
Because I'd be, moving from one side of the boat to the other side of the boat, you know, to keep up with the heavy gusts of wind. But it was a small town, a very middle-class environment, and I was there until I went away to high school, and I went to it was probably the most it changed me probably more than anything else, and I went to a military boarding academy in Culver, Indiana. And it was a great opportunity, and I went from being a relatively small fish in a small pond to a tiny little minnow in a big pond. Culver was an extraordinary place. It had kids from literally all over the world that went there, and it's a school that focuses on leadership.
Okay.
And it's very global. And I went off from there to the University of Florida, where I got an engineering degree. And then I've been in manufacturing and quality control ever since.
So your roots are in leadership.
It goes back quite. I'm still learning a lot, but
Interesting. And so with regard to that, tell me a little bit about East West Manufacturing and what you do there.
So let me tell you how we got to East West Manufacturing.
Okay.
When I graduated from engineering school in the early 90s, I took a job as an engineer for Boston Scientific, making medical instruments. And I learned a lot about quality and high-volume quality manufacturing in that environment. From there, I worked for PricewaterhouseCoopers. That's when I came to Atlanta, and I was in their global strategies and supply chain group. And so I lived on an airplane for a couple of years, but got to learn a lot about supply chain logistics and manufacturing from a global perspective. And so I started my first company with my brother, around 98, and he at the time had been living in Asia for 14 years, and he knew a lot about the cultures and what the advantages were. And so we got together and we started a company called ITS, where we manufactured electronic assemblies for the automotive industry. And back then, toys were coming out of China, and that was about it. There wasn't much more, and we knew that quality was really more dependent on not necessarily where it's being made, but more on the expectations and the understandings of the process.
Okay.
And so that was the gap that we filled. And so we quickly got a nice account where we were making circuit boards that went into Cadillacs through a Tier 2 automotive company. And then we got we were making the cruise controls that went into the Toyota Corollas and the Camrys. And that right gave us a lot of credibility. And so in 98, as we all know, the dot-com was pretty hot, and everybody needed to have a dot-com company, including my brother. and so he and I went around on that, and I wanted to stay in manufacturing. So I ended up selling my half of the business back to him. And I went to a company here in Atlanta called Diversitech, who was a customer of ours. And I joined their team. I went to the owner. I made it more or less a no-brainer for him. I said, you know, through me, you'll be able to buy from all our sources that we had established in China, which will more than offset any compensation you want to give me. and I had, at the time, a background, I still do, in warehousing, logistics, and supply chain. And so I was able to bring a lot to the table. And so I joined Diversitech in 2000 or 1999. And for a couple of years, was running those divisions of Diversitech, and they enjoyed some very good growth. And it was in 2001 when I said, you know, I don't have a very big equity position in Diversitech, and I'd like to take this model that we've developed for offshore manufacturing and put it out on its own.
Okay.
And so that's what we did in 2001. We set up a joint venture between myself, another partner, and Diversitech. And it's been a great model. I didn't want to start from no capital and no business. I wanted it, and that's really why we wanted to pull Diversitech in on that venture, and it turned out to be a you know, over the last 10 years, a great run. So East West, we're a global manufacturer. We've got our job is to manufacture products in those regions of the world where we think it's most advantageous.
Okay.
There's a lot of variables that go into that. It's not just labor. It's what the material availability, the supply chain, the taxes, the skills of that particular region. There's a lot of things that weigh into that decision. And so we do manufacture. We've got about 5,000 products that we make today. We make products for a lot of companies, Fortune 500 companies that you would know of, and a lot of smaller companies that you wouldn't. We act as their supply chain. And we take a lot of companies that don't have the resources to think on and operate on a global level, and we bring that to them. We focus on products that involve metals, plastics, rubber. We own a motor factory that makes electrical motors. We do a lot in the way of electronics, and we're even doing some industrial textiles today. In our facilities, we have a couple of facilities in China. We have our motor factory there. We've got three factories now in Vietnam. An office in Ho Chi Minh, and we're now just expanding into India, and we just set up an office there. We also do some business in Thailand and Indonesia, but the majority of it is still China, Vietnam, and India.
In India.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so our job is to, you know, we work with companies, and we figure out what they're good at, what we're good at, and we try and find that subset where we can work together and help them stay competitive.
So they outsource their manufacturing to you.
Right.
Basically.
Right. The things that are best, that best fit with what our skills are.
Okay. So you actually would get in there and talk with business owners or companies, mm-hmm, at the strategic level and say, well, this makes sense or this doesn't. Or perhaps it could make sense years from now,
right,
and not quite today.
Right.
Okay.
Well, most of the companies we work with are interested in
doing it now?
Increasing their competitive advantage.
I understand.
Right. And they realize that, you know, that to do that in today's world, you got to look around the world to find out where those regions are where I can most benefit, mm-hmm, from that. And so our job is to sit with these guys and to help them figure that out.
Okay. So how's business? How are things going?
Business has been good. Business has been good. We're having a great year. Last year, we were the 14th fastest growing company in the state of Georgia.
Wow.
We were recognized for that, and we're really proud of it. This year, we're having another great year. We doubled the size of the business in the last 3 years, and we expect to double it again in the next three.
Now, is that the outputs of the business or the
revenue.
The infrastructure? Revenue. Okay.
That's revenue.
Got it.
Revenue.
Got it.
So and we expect to be over $100 million in the next 3 years.
Well, fantastic. So you know what they say is that every good leader has a great team.
And we have a great team.
And I've looked on your website, and I've seen some great people. So tell us a little bit about those folks and how you've actually organized that, because it gives us a little insight into some of your leadership ability, and we'll talk a little bit more as we move through this conversation.
Well, I mean, building a team is the hardest part of my job, and it's because it's been hard to find the folks with the unique skill sets that we're looking for in particular areas. And we've got some, the team we have in place is fantastic, and I couldn't be more proud of what we've been able to put together. A lot of uniquely talented individuals. And you know, as long as we create a great culture for them to work in, which I think we do a good job of, then and we have a great definition of success, then they tend to we tend to retain those folks that we want to keep around. But finding and attracting that is you know, frankly, has been a challenge. I mean, we've got, for example, the gentleman that runs our Asia operation. We call him Marco Polo. His name is Fritz, and Fritz speaks five languages fluently.
Wow.
And he just to give you an example, in India, he rode a bicycle 20 years ago around the entire perimeter of India. Mm-hmm. Fritz is from Winnipeg, Canada, coldest place on earth, right?
Yes.
But Fritz has traveled, you know, I think I've traveled a lot. I've got nothing on Fritz.
Wow.
And so Fritz is the guy that helps us figure out where we need to be going next. He understands the cultures. He understands how to work with owners of factories in these regions. He understands how to, more importantly, coach a lot of the folks that we work with so they become stronger and more suitable partners for us. And I bring him up as an example because finding a guy like Fritz, you know, you just can't put an ad on monster.com. what we do is, you know, I found Fritz because he was working with a partner of ours, and he and I became friends, and I wanted him on our team.
Right.
You know, and so
right.
So I shared my vision with him, and I invited him on, and set up a real attractive position for him, and he's excelled at it.
You made him an offer he couldn't refuse.
I tried. Yeah, I did, I guess. But you know, we've got a lot of folks on our team that have very unique skill sets, and we don't we try and find folks that have the aptitude and the can-do attitude, and even if they don't necessarily have all the experience, if you've got those two things going for you, you can go a long way. You know, we can give them the experience, and a lot of folks, you know, we've had some that continue to climb that ladder and grow year after year, and then we've got, you know, others that have struggled with that.
Okay.
And these are the things that, you know, as you grow your team, especially when you're doubling the size of your business, you know, every 3 years, you run into situations where people don't grow as fast as the company's growing.
Correct.
And that's always a difficult situation, but something, you know, it's just part of growing a business.
And so you've worked on the domestic side as well as the global, obviously.
Yeah, my responsibility in the business is mostly around operations.
Okay.
I mean, my title is CEO, but I mean, I probably am more on the operating side than anything else. And my partner, Jeff, is responsible for all the sales and marketing activity.
So you're both in your true strengths.
Yes.
Yeah. So when you look at the team composition, getting back to like Fritz and what he does, mm-hmm. When you look at that, obviously you've got a domestic background, you've got a global background, you're making great money and doing great things with the global side and East-West manufacturing. So are there subtle differences or major differences between people that you want to try to put on your team to fit the global environment versus the domestic environment? Are there differences there?
Well, the guys in the global environment tend to speak more languages.
Ah.
For one.
So the number one tip for our listeners is it won't hurt you to learn another language.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the guy, if you're operating, well, for example, the gentleman who runs the Vietnam plant, who's the general manager there, Matt, he's from Texas.
Okay.
He went to, he started off as an engineer in Dell, and then he went over to, I believe it was Emerson. And he knew that to really differentiate himself, he wanted to be unique, right? I mean, mm-hmm. he had to do something different. So 10 years ago, he hopped on a plane and went to China and learned Mandarin, intensive mm-hmm. Mandarin. He quit his job. Mm-hmm. And for I think it was a year, maybe 2 years, he lived on a, you know, inland China campus learning Mandarin.
True immersion.
True immersion, yeah. And then he got a job running a factory in China.
Okay.
That was, I think, owned by a UK company. And then we found him. And at the time, he might have been 27, 28 years old.
Wow.
And so finding a guy like Matt's going to be pretty hard to do, right?
Okay.
And so we got lucky. We ran across him while looking to fill a position in our Shenzhen office. And we, you know, when I saw that resume, even though he wasn't necessarily an ideal fit for the position we had open, I saw it and I said, this is a guy we got to hire. We got to make a position for him because he's got exactly the right kind of ambition that fits well. He's entrepreneurial. He's willing to try and experiment new things around building himself. And so he ran the quality group for our China team for a couple of years. And then when we built our first factory in Vietnam, we ended up moving him down there to run that. And now he's done a great job. You know, he manages a factory with several hundred people in it.
Okay. So I would imagine that, you know, as you go through and compose teams over the years, you've done it because you've done it for several years. I know you have. You don't always hit a home run,
no.
Right? There are some people that you bring on, and you talked a little bit about that earlier.
Right.
You know, where there's some things that perhaps could work with their personal agenda that works with East West. And
right.
if it doesn't, then they decouple and they move on. And so looking back, how important is it to continue to make those calls, even though you know they won't be 100% successful? You won't be 100% successful all the time.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you're admitting failure. We all do. But some people, they actually understand that failure is a part of the success.
Absolutely. And, yeah, you don't – heck, if I batted, you know, 50% most of the time, I feel like I'd be doing pretty well. I mean, you certainly, when it comes to hiring folks, you go with what you think is the best decision at the time. But there's times when – You know, after the first week, you're looking at yourself saying, is this the person I hired? What happened here?
Right.
And in our culture, you know, and this happens a lot, one of the important things of our culture is it's we're not a 9-to-5 company. We're the antithesis of that, in fact. You know, in the first 8 or 9 years, people used to say, well, what are your working hours? In fact, when that would happen in an interview, it's usually a red flag for me.
Ooh.
Because we don't have working hours.
And, understood.
Yeah,
you're following the sun most times.
And
right?
I'd say if you've got nothing to do, you don't need to show up to work. You know, and I've been in those companies, and I used to see this when I was a consultant, where 5 o'clock would come around, and all of a sudden you'd have mass exodus. The place would just you'd feel the vacuum of people running out the door, and I couldn't believe it. You know, I'm like, what are these people? How could you just sit in your job all day? You know, and know that as soon as 5 o'clock runs around, your job's done. You run out the door. And how could your schedule be set up that way?
Yeah.
And so, you know, my belief is if you don't have anything to do, you don't need to be there, right?
Right.
And so it was for the first like 8 or 9 years when folks would ask me what the working hours, I said, well, we don't have any. And then people had the hard time getting their head around that.
And
I say, as long as you do what we're asking you to do, you know, you can work whatever schedule you want. And we've had to, now that we've gotten a lot bigger and we got a lot more people, we've had to put some rigidity around that.
Right.
But it's a very flexible schedule, and it's more about being there when everybody else is there, so we can have meetings together. But other than that, we have a work from home policy. We have flexible start hours. We have flexible leave hours. We like people to work 40 hours a week, but you know, if you got to work 50, 60 hours this week to do what needs to be done,
then
that's what we expect.
Okay. Yeah. And that is part of the culture question I was going to ask too. But so you're describing it versus trying to just define it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I like that piece of it. What you're basically saying is you'll do what we need you to do.
Right.
And to the extent that you can, we can use you, and East West can continue to be strong and viable.
Right. And to go back to your question where we've hired folks that have not worked well within our corporation, that's been one of the common themes that we've seen. Some people struggle to work in that kind of framework. They don't like it to be as open-ended. They want that, I get here at 9, I clock in, you know, and then I leave at 5 and I clock out. You know?
That's interesting.
And that's not the culture that we breed. And so we've, you know, finding people that can work well in that framework is and it's more entrepreneurial, it's more accountable.
Mm-hmm.
People are held accountable for what they're, you know, in the large companies, if you don't get your job done, somebody else is probably looking over you and they can get it done. There's probably 3 layers of oversight. You know, in East West, you know, it's all you.
Pretty flat.
It's all you. And if you don't get your job done,
we're in trouble.
We got it. Yeah, people know about it, and it'll become an issue.
So with regard to that, the kind of person that could really that really makes that work for you, you know, interestingly enough, when I look at your background, obviously it comes from a very, I would say, structured background. I mean, you've been to a military academy, boarding mm-hmm. school, then certainly there's structure. I'm certain you had to get up at a certain time.
Oh, yeah.
There were certain things that were expected during the day. And so my next question is going to be, kind of ambiguous, but hopefully you'll be able to draw some discipline out of that. When you're looking for people that can actually do what you need them to do at East West, and certainly what you're doing, you're looking for people who can emulate what you do. Mm-hmm. Do you look for people who come from a background of discipline or more a background of ambiguity? I would think that it would be more disciplined people who can understand when you need to step in at 9 or when the customer needs right. this and be more flexible. But what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it would be the latter. I mean, we're at the core, we're an engineering-driven company. I'm okay. an engineer. Jeff's an engineer. We've got over 50 engineers in the company, and we're process-driven from that perspective. We create processes for most anything we do. Whether it's developing a new product, whether it's in the manufacturing side, whether it's on the administrative side, we have processes that control these things. And when we make mistakes, which we do, we go back and say, all right, what happened? Where did the process break down?
Do a debrief.
Yeah, where did the process break down, and what could we have done differently to improve it so that it won't happen again? And then we get our arms around that, and we implement whatever action items are required. And we've got to, no matter what side of the company you're on, whether you're in sales, engineering, administration, accounting, those fundamentals are there.
Okay,
and so to you know the kind of individual that's going to excel in that is going to be somebody that can handle, that structure, right? And again, it's not about hours. Time has nothing to do with it.
Right, right.
You know, it's about controlling your schedule and what your priorities and action items are, and then doing what you say you're going to do. You know, following up and completing whatever responsibility has been assigned to you.
Which actually goes back to perhaps what you may have as values of the company.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's a huge one. It's probably my number one.
Okay. You have a couple of others on top of your head that you might be able to give us your top three values for the company?
I do. I think I've listed a couple, right?
Yeah.
The process-driven, certainly. The can-do attitude. Bright people. And then, you know, I'd have to throw in we have fun.
Okay.
I think that's a big part of it. You know, we like what we're doing. We think we're doing a good thing, and we want to make sure that we have an environment where people are having fun doing it. You know, and it's not to say, you know, sometimes we'll have a quality issue, and those things can drain the life out of you. You know, when you run, but all hands come on deck to help fix it when it happens. And we've been fortunate through the years where when they have happened, we've reacted positively. In fact, almost every time our customers come to us and are so complimentary about how we've dealt with these situations. But you got to make sure the environment is fun. And so what we do every quarter, we do something fun.
Ah.
That's our policy. Every quarter we have to do something fun.
So what was last quarter?
We were skeet shooting.
Skeet shooting?
Yeah. We went up and went skeet shooting. At the whole company.
Nice.
Yeah, we took a big bus. A big bus that had, I don't know, like lightning bolts on the side. A party bus.
A party bus.
A party bus. Picked us up at the office, and then we went up to some place where they had guides that took all of us out into teams and on golf carts, and we shot skeet.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Now, the total number of employees is
in the company it's about 350, but here in Atlanta it's 25
in Atlanta. Okay, well, great. So aside from dollars, Scott, how do you measure success, yours as well as the team at East West?
Well, the first thing, you know, to be successful, you have to have goals, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have to set the goals that define your success. And so one of the things we do, you know, at the beginning of every year, I sit down with our executive team and I say, what are goals for this year? And these goals are not necessarily financially driven goals. Indirectly, they should result in growth for the business. But these would be things like setting up an office in India. That was a goal for us this year. Another goal for us was setting up a new manufacturing process in our Vietnam operation. A third one was making and selling our own product. Today, of the 5,000 products we make, they're all made for somebody else with their name on it. East West does not have any of its own products.
Okay.
And so we're developing this year a plan around doing that. So we set forth about 10 goals every year that everybody buys into. And I don't do more than that because I feel like we'd get lost, you know, with too many, and I don't do less because then I don't feel like we're doing enough. So 10 feels like it's about the right number.
Okay.
For us. And these are common goals across the company. And if you go into my office, you'll see a whiteboard, and all 10 of these things will be written on the whiteboard. And then every quarter we meet and as a company, and we discuss how we're doing on each of these things. And each of the goals has a specific leader.
Okay.
For it, that's in charge of putting the organization around trying to achieve that goal. And so quarterly we talk about it and say how we're doing. And then at the end of the year, I give us a report. I usually get everybody together and say, well, here's what I think we did well. Here's what we didn't do so well. Mm-hmm. And here's how we did on each of these goals. And that helps us define, you know, how successful we were in that year. Sounds very process-driven, doesn't it?
It certainly sounds like an engineer came up with this, no doubt about it. So if I understand what you're saying is you set goals, you set a number, which is 10, and then you also, as I go back over the conversation we've had thus far, you've hired the right people. So there's a great fit between what the individual is looking for and what the organization needs to prosper.
Right. So guess who was in charge of building the office in India? Right,
I think I'm looking at him.
No, it was Fritz.
It's Fritz,
right?
Good.
Right. So Fritz would be the guy for that. And so for every one of these, you know, there would be somebody that would be responsible for making that happen.
Good. And then you handle the strategic side of it.
Yeah.
And which is what the ultimate leader should be doing, right?
Right.
Focusing between leadership, strategic, and as well as tactical. So, you know, we talk a lot about leadership. And so when I look back on some of the things that I carry in my pocket, I actually have a little card that says an actual definition of leadership from years ago when I worked at Bell South. And it says, the art of mobilizing people to tackle tough challenges and find appropriate solutions. Hmm. And there's a lot in that definition, no doubt about it. So what is your definition of leadership?
That.
You take that one.
Can I read that?
Take that one.
The art of mobilizing people.
It's a huge piece of influence is what I take
from
that's
fantastic. That's really fantastic. I mean, that's, you know, I'm not sure I can come up with a one sentence that defines what I think leadership is. But it's about putting a team together certainly. And it's about energizing that team to accomplish a common goal, right?
And being able to do that over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And being able to do that not only in your professional life, but also in your personal life. Mm. And
Absolutely.
Also to help other people as well from a community perspective, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
So what do you get involved in community service-wise?
Well, there's been a number of things. I've recently been on the board of the Dream House for Kids, which is a program that helps children that can't really live on their own, mm-hmm. and have high needs. And this is up in Lawrenceville. I just joined up with what's called the Wills Club out of Children's Healthcare. There's some programs there. I'm on the China Research Center, the board there, and also the Georgia China Alliance. So those are some of the community programs I get involved in. My daughter's school, of course, there's those activities that, you know, that we get involved in. Those are the primary ones that I'm involved in.
Well, good. I do know that you speak to college students and grad students.
That's right.
On a fairly often basis.
Yeah, I've spoken to a number of the schools around town, Kennesaw State most recently. Mm-hmm. And I speak about, well, a number of things. I talk about the kind of the entrepreneurial side of my experience. I speak about China over the last 20 years, what I've seen on the manufacturing side. I started going over there in 93, and I've made roughly 100 trips in 20 years.
Wow.
To China, and so I've seen a lot over the years. And then I talk about what the global landscape is today in manufacturing, you know, how China fits into it with Vietnam and India and Mexico and the U.S. And then lastly, I speak about what I think the U.S. should and could be doing to better compete on a global landscape.
Okay.
And that's a big conversation.
Yeah, I would imagine that is quite a conversation.
I'm not sure we want to go into that one.
So have you seen a common set of questions that come back to you from these college students and these grad students? I can think of several off the top of my head, but what, are you hearing something that's perhaps a common theme?
I get a lot of great feedback. I get a lot of folks that are concerned, you know, with some of the things that the U.S. is doing on, and when I say the U.S., I mean, it's just that we're not adapting as fast as a lot of these other, you know, as Europe has in this area, as certainly Asia has.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some, we're frustrated optimists in that regard. You know, and I get questions from folks saying, you know, what advice can I give them, you know, to start a business, you know, and so that they can take risk. And I've taken some big ones.
Right.
And that's one of the things that I, you know, if I were to give advice to anybody, you know, it would be to differentiate yourself in some way, whatever it may be, and then to take the chance, to take the risk, to go out there and try it. You know, if it's starting up a operation in, you know, Ethiopia, you know, hop on a plane and go to Ethiopia and figure out what it's going to take, you know. Or if it's starting a business here in Atlanta, you know, you take the chances.
You know, interestingly enough, you said that, and I think you and I even perhaps chatted about this before we started this broadcast. Your opinion is that it works best when you just do immersion. So what was your process when you started and opened the office in India? And is that the same process you followed when you were in China?
Well, I want to. Can I tell the Vietnam story? Because that was more
do.
Fun. Then it can lead to India.
Please
so,
do.
So when we were, this is 2004, we were doing all of our manufacturing, and in China was almost, it was pretty much the only game in town as far as we were concerned in the products we were manufacturing. But we knew we needed to expand outside of China and differentiate and diversify. A lot of our customers had too much concentration there, and they wanted to have alternate manufacturing locations.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and I did some of this when I was at PwC. I did some of this kind of work looking at, like for example, when Ford bought Volvo, I was on the team that had to look, understand, and analyze what that needed to look like on a global level. And where you start, what you start doing is look at what the strengths are of each of these different countries, and where you, and you have to factor in all these different things, not just labor, like I said, but taxes, regulation, you know how, et cetera. So Vietnam was obvious at the time. It was almost a no-brainer when you looked at things like GDP per capita, when you looked at what the incentives that they had for investment, and so on. And we had looked at other regions. We looked at South America. We looked at Indonesia, India at the time. And so at the time, Vietnam looked like it was, and most of this was around rubber business that we had already in China. So we went down to Vietnam with the intent of finding a rubber supplier that could manufacture our rubber products. So Fritz and I hopped on a plane. We flew into Hanoi and we didn't have a hotel room or anything. We just got in there and looked around and spent 4 or 5 days touring Hanoi looking for factories that could support us. And we, at the time, it really felt like Hanoi was not open for business.
Hmm.
That was the impression that we got. It was still, I guess, communist for any practical purposes. It did not feel like it was business friendly at an international level. We got done. We hopped on the plane, flew down to Ho Chi Minh. Exactly the opposite feeling.
Wow.
It was. You could just tell it on the streets, the street vendors, and the vibe and the energy, that it was a place on the go.
Okay.
You know, and so the next thing we had to do is we had to find where the rubber suppliers. Well, it turns out there's a Yellow Pages in Vietnam, so we flipped open the Yellow Pages. Mm-hmm. There were rubber suppliers, and there were about 20 of them listed, and so. You know, who would have thought, right? Who would have thought? And so we get our map out, and we draw all the dots on the map as to where some guys had to help us figure that out.
Right.
And then the next thing we had to do was hire a guy that could drive us around to see all these places.
A guide,
right? So we had to do an instant, we needed a taxi that we could hire for a day, and there's plenty of people that would do that, but there aren't many taxi drivers that can speak English in Vietnam. So we had to give an instant taxi driver English test, and we were doing it to about 50 people at the same time, because the more you were interviewing, the more people were showing up. And I'll never forget that sight with all these, you know, I'm asking people questions in English, and they were just staring at me. But anyway, we found our guy, and we hired him for 3 days, I think it was. And he took us around to, you know, follow the map, follow the dots, and we went to all these factories, and, you know, we'd stop along the way and get a banana or something, and it was really a lot of fun. And we'd go to a factory, and we'd pull out in front, and if it looked like somebody where we'd want to visit, we'd call them up. and say, you know, hi, I'm Scott from East West, and I'd like to take a tour of your factory.
Now, you're sitting outside the
gates. Yeah.
And you're making the call.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And then normally he would say, well, send us a letter and we'll make arrangements and we'll get prepared. And I would say, well, actually, I'm at your front gate right now and I'd like to come inside. And, you know, he'd pause for a second. And next thing you know, you'd see like a head poke out the window. Yeah. And then they let us inside. And through that process, we went into four or five different factories, and we found one that was really good. And so through that, we moved a bunch of our business down there, and we were able to save a lot of money. And now we've probably got 20 suppliers in Vietnam. But it's all stories like that that have just and I'll tell you what happens when you go to a place like Vietnam and you find a great supplier. If you ask him about other suppliers that are in different spaces like plastics or whatever, he's going to lead you to other good suppliers.
Very good. So great referral.
So it expands very quickly from there.
Mm.
You just got to, and that's how you build your relationships.
Mm. Interesting. Very, very interesting. So, you know, when I first saw you, maybe perhaps a couple of months ago at the Coles Breakfast Series, what impressed me was here's a gentleman that actually has, and you pointed out, done 100 trips between here and China over the last several years, and you look as fresh as a daisy. So, I I'm running into people every other day that never have taken an international trip, and they look tired all the time. What in the heck is Scott Ellison doing to stay on top of his game? How are you staying in shape? I mean, you know, look like you're in balance. And
would you believe me if I told you I had open heart surgery a year ago?
Really?
Yeah, I did. It had nothing to do with, I do exercise a lot, but I blew a valve. It's hereditary. But actually, I bounced back pretty quick because I do try and keep in good shape. But I do boot camp at two or three times a week, and I run when I'm not, and I try and stay up on my readings. You know, to stay balanced, I listen to NPR, and then I read the Wall Street Journal, and I think somewhere between the two, I'm getting some pretty good advice. And then also, you know, I'm a member of Vistage. I don't know if you know what that is, but that's a CEO organization here in Atlanta, and I've been in there for a while now, over 8 years, and there's, I guess, 14 or 15 CEOs in my group, and they're mentors and advisors and they're at all different levels in their career, and they're in all different industries. And so I meet with them monthly, and when I have an issue that I'm struggling with, I put it out on the table, and usually they spin me around and make me nauseous. And you know, after that process, I usually walk out with some pretty darn good advice.
Well, that sounds like a winner. You know? Again, I am impressed with the fact that you really do look like you're on top of your game. And so that's important. Now, the other gentleman in the room that looks like he's on top of his game is Dr. Hariharan. So as we transition from Scott Ellison, the CEO of East West Manufacturing, an Atlanta-based offshore manufacturing and supply chain management company, an engineer by trade, basically, with 300-plus employees globally and 25 here in Atlanta, we transition to Dr. Hariharan. So, Dr. Hariharan, how are you doing today?
Doing very well, thanks. That was a fascinating conversation with Scott. I've heard Scott speak at multiple events, and I've had the great pleasure of getting to meet him many, many times, and he never ceases to amaze me.
Yeah, and neither do you. You know, you were the guy that actually was part of the first trip I ever took to India, and India is your home, correct?
Yes.
So fill us in a little bit on your personal background.
Well, I was born in India, in the southern part of India, and did most of my education there, so in the south as well as in Delhi.
Okay.
And I think one of the major transformations for me, other than my family, a factor that really molded me was the Lions Club in India had a competition back when I was just entering college, and they picked about 14 people from across India to go and live in different parts of Asia at Lions Club members' houses for prolonged periods of time. So about 6 months I spent traveling around in Asia, and that was just phenomenal. It was phenomenal, I think, more in the sense of gave me a lot more confidence in my ability to deal with people, you know, to understand and try to work with people from different cultures. You know, because even though when you think of Asia, it's every part of Asia is very different.
Yes.
And so you got thrown into the mix more or less, and it was exciting. It was absolutely exciting.
Interesting. How about a little bit of your international? Now, how old were you when you did this this immersion with the lions?
Probably about 18, 17, 18.
Okay. So take us a little bit further through your international education.
So then after that, I went to college in Delhi and didn't know what I wanted to do. And some of my friends had already moved to the U.S. to study. I applied, and they gave me a scholarship, so I came over. And
now, you're simplifying awful lot now.
No. See, one of the fascinating things, let me digress for a minute, because I want to revert back to Scott's point and your question in regards to being methodical, having a methodical approach. I had a classmate in Delhi who then followed him, or he followed me, but we're very, very close friends. And we were housemates in Buffalo as well as here in Atlanta. So when he was living with me in Atlanta, he was based in Indianapolis, was here for a week, every mm-hmm. other week. Mm-hmm. And during the time, he would get up at precisely the same time in the morning, would go through the same rituals. Then on the way out and on his way to work at precisely that time, he would stop in at the Starbucks, this one location in Starbucks, order one cup of hot water with two bags of a specific brand of tea, pick up three napkins. The napkins would always be placed in the same exact places in the car. And so when I was teaching courses which had to do with a lot of data management and optimization courses, I used to bring up my friend Ambu Jain's name as a reference, because I call him System Jain. I'm kind of at the other extreme at that point, very disorganized. And it took me four times to do as much as he could accomplish, because I was constantly learning new things. It was exciting, of course, but you don't. It's not an efficient way to go about it. Uh-huh. And so System Jain, so I was telling my students, and I asked him, I used to make fun of him all the time about this. And I said, man, you're anal about this, right? And he said, well, Govin, keep in mind I'm divorced. I have two kids that I take care of. And I have a really hectic job. Things happen all the time. The more things that I automate in my work and in my life, the more when, say, the teacher of one of my kids calls me up, I'm able to handle that crisis without throwing everything off.
Interesting.
And so that was the reason why I digress was because, that point that Scott made was absolutely legitimate. I did not plan much in my life. I'd just been blessed with wonderful friends. Whatever mistake I made, there was always people to point me in the right direction, give me a good kick in the behind, and send me on my way. So like that, I ended up in the U.S. to do my PhD in economics. And that was a subject that came very naturally to me. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't too difficult. I could continue to go along being disorganized and whatnot. Then I went, I finished my PhD and went and worked at West Virginia University for 2 years. And then SUNY Buffalo hired me back, this time as a faculty. So I was a faculty there in the business school as well as the law school. And for many years. Then I started a company going back to 1999. So we had an idea, two other friends of mine, to start a business, right? A technology business. Now, of course, I'm from India, so you had to start a technology
Absolutely.
Company.
Absolutely.
And that is when it really hit home. There you have your skin in the game.
Yes.
You got every penny that you can borrow in your name tied up in the startup. And the more mistakes that you make in there, the more you realize, man, I need to really get this act together, you know? You have to have a system in place, because just like in the case of System Jane, if you didn't, there are going to be these unexpected shocks that come up. And when you look behind to handle that, everything else falls apart.
Right.
So we had that company for a couple of years. We tried to set it up. We had some good successes, and then we couldn't raise funds any further in 2001.
Okay.
And ended up closing down shop in 2002. So I was looking for, during that time, I also had a great gig in Buffalo, you know, in the sense of they let me do things that I really love to do.
At the university?
At the university.
Okay.
And of course, I was expected to deliver in everything that I picked up, and that was okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent most of my winters. Now, those of you who have ever been to Buffalo know winter in Buffalo is not the most fun, right? It's prolonged, and it's very gloomy and a lot of snow. Most of my winters were spent in Asia.
Really?
So I was in India. I was in China most of the time. I was teaching the executive programs for Buffalo there, as well as doing training for Motorola in China and Singapore. So I spent most of my time in these two places, a little bit in India. And I would come back to Buffalo when the weather had turned nice and warm.
Nice. Very so nice. Snowbird, right? A global snowbird.
Exactly. I follow where the great weather is, right?
That's too smart. So, and now, today, you're actually the executive director at the India-China-America, or ICA.
Mm-hmm.
And so, tell us a little bit about ICA and its overall mission.
What we try to do, you know, this is not trying to keep referring back to Scott,
mm-hmm.
but
inescapable, right?
You know, I'm a lot older than Scott, and so one thing I can definitely say is that the older I get, the more I realize how much I have to learn from others. That is fantastic. There is, you know, so when he speaks about, for instance, the need for system, I already told you about that.
Mm-hmm.
The second part is, you know, he belongs to organizations that wherein they're able to help each other in formulating appropriate strategies to or appropriate solutions for global problems, right? Whether it is in the context of figuring out what is the most the effective way for the U.S. to become have a competitive advantage,
right,
vis-a-vis some of these countries. And so that, in a nutshell, is what we try to do. So we bring together people like Scott, who are really solid in terms of their background, in terms of their experience and their brain power, along with people from governments who have been responsible for formulating these policies at the public sector level, and people from academia, to create a knowledge base that can help address these problems, right?
A true triad.
Yeah. It is. It absolutely is. And the reason why we pick these three countries, again, if you attack or if you're able to address a problem in these three countries, which have the three biggest populations in the world, then you can do it anywhere.
Yes.
You know?
Okay.
And whether it is you're looking at them as the three biggest markets or you're looking at them as the three biggest populations, that becomes the best platform to develop these policies. And they're also very important to each other.
Hmm.
Right. So we've bring together the best minds to help solve business-related problems.
What other problem could there be that is worth solving other than business-related problems? Because personal problems even do emanate sometimes from business-related problems, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so with regard to the ICA and all of this about what you're doing and how you're bringing together people from government, people from academia, and people in the real world in the private sector who are actually making things happen in that great, glorious triangle you've got there. How can one become involved or more involved with the ICA if they're listening to this message today?
The first thing I would recommend is that you go to our website, www.icainstitute.org, and you'll find a long list of events, videos. There's even one of Scott's PowerPoint set from before, from the breakfast series that he was kind enough to send to us. And so you'll find a bunch of information as well as some of the activities that we engage in. Now, shoot me an email. You can reach me at, you'll find my email address there. You can also subscribe to our briefs. And we'll get you on your mail on the mailing list. But if you have specific problems, you know, essentially we're trying to isolate very narrow issues, like the unbanked, for instance, right? The unbanked is a major issue for companies that are in the financial world to start with, right? So a company like Equifax, for instance, I've been speaking to them for many years, and their biggest challenge is what do you do when you don't have information, financial information, on a majority of the population, which happens in emerging markets where they don't participate in the banking system formally. And this is an issue that the governments are involved in. We have the same issue in the U.S., but in a very different format and flavor and not as extensive. So we try to isolate that type of an issue, bring together these three countries and people from companies such as Equifax who've been helping with this, people from the Ministry of Finance in these countries, the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, et cetera, and try to come up with collaborative solutions.
So these are pretty high-level people you're working with, people from obviously other countries, and very high-level people, very influential. So you get to see a lot of different leadership styles as you look across the spectrum of the people you interact with.
Exactly.
So what have you found in your travels, going from your background and even up to today, that seems to be the best type of leadership to get things done?
Can you pull out that card again? No, but it is absolutely important what that card said, because you know, I can tell you from my failures, which is quite a few, and I'm very aware of what I've learned from them. And the number one thing is I don't have the time and definitely not the skill set to be able to do everything myself.
Very good.
If I don't have the right people with me, it doesn't matter whether I'm working 24/7 or not. It's not going to work.
Hmm. And with that in mind, you do have a set of great people that actually work with you at the ICA Institute. If you have a moment, could you acknowledge them?
Oh, absolutely. We are actually most, and it's a one-man show only in the sense that there's one paid person, that is me. The rest of the people, we have one research associate who gets who works with us on the sector briefs, etc. But the rest of the people are all volunteers.
Okay.
So we have a specific problem. Right? Say, for instance, it is how do you speed up the regulatory process in India?
Mm-hmm.
So we then tap into people of such as Scott, bring them together with people from, say, the Indian government, who are, say, the Ministry of Industry, whoever is responsible for that, and then put together a report on that basis.
Okay.
You know, so it is much more a global network of scholars from industry, from government,
true,
and from academia.
Yep.
So we have a very vast network like that, and that is primarily how we do this.
So that is the key. So, gentlemen, I'd like to ask each of you, if you were looking to find your successor in the role you have today, if you need to replace yourself tomorrow, what three attributes would be absolutely critical to their success? Scott, why don't we put you on the hot seat?
Down to three, huh?
Yeah, just the top three. Julie Miller, our recruiter, would love me to be able to make sure that you respond to this.
Well, you have to be a leader. I mean, that's and you could boil leader down to 10 things that make up a leader. But you know, it's I mean, you have to be good at working with your team and inspiring them.
Okay, so that's one. You have to be a leader.
Yeah. In my job, you got to be analytical.
Okay.
You need to be able to read numbers like it's a story, and you need to be able to interpret what the analysis says and be able to make good decisions from it.
Okay.
So you got to, I have an engineering background, so I'm technical. In our business, that certainly helps to have that, the analytics and the technical side. So I'd put that as number, two.
Mm-hmm.
And then three, energy.
Energy.
You got to have a lot of energy. It's not a 9-to-5 job. You got to be willing to hop on the planes and do the travel and do whatever it takes.
Okay. So when you look at number two, analytical, I would actually wonder whether or not you would boil down competence in there, because you hit on it a couple of times. I'm sure the competence is part of the analytical piece
Absolutely.
Of it as well.
Absolutely. I mean, that comes down to education, certainly, and in the sciences, you don't necessarily have to have an engineering degree, but a business, economics, you just need to be able to understand numbers.
Yeah, and even if you don't have an engineering degree, as long as you're combined with someone who does have one, if it's necessary for what you're trying to do, then it is certainly a subdimension and a critical success factor. Mm-hmm. So thank you for that. So Dr. Hariharan, if you're looking to find your successor in the role you have tomorrow, what three attributes would you say are critical?
I'd say, first of all, focus.
Okay.
Because, and the reason why focus is a very, very important thing is because it's very easy to get digressed. So you ask me a question and I say, let me digress for a minute, right? You can't do that at work, because there is going to be a bombardment of issues that are happening around the world. Now, which countries do you focus in? Which sectors? Which issues? You have to stay focused, otherwise you can't deliver. You need to also, from my experience, really be able to work with people.
Okay.
You have to somehow, even if it is something that they started off not having the passion for, you have to make them passionate about this one thing that they all hate. And that's a very difficult problem. And the third thing is passion.
Passion.
I think you need to have a passion for what you're doing. Otherwise, you'll get burned out very quickly.
So a couple of things I think I've heard both of you say when you talk about being a leader, Scott, you're certainly weaving in the fact that people need to have interpersonal skills.
Absolutely.
Because it's very difficult to be able to influence someone when you can't connect with them, correct, gentlemen?
Absolutely.
Anything to say on that one little item?
I completely agree with you.
Okay.
It's essential.
Well, fantastic. So I'm going to move and ask you a kind of a closing question. We've been spending time, folks, with Scott Ellison, CEO of East West Manufacturing, and Dr. Govind Hariharan, the executive director of the ICA Institute, currently housed at Kennesaw State University's Coase College of Business. And as those of you who've heard me on this show before know, I could talk all day with y'all because I'm really getting a lot of information from you. But obviously, you're businessmen and business has to carry on. So with that in mind, my final question for each of you, and your answer to this question will be posted on our blog separately from the rest of our conversation. So which business book has most impacted your leadership ability? Govind, would you like to go first, sir?
Yeah, I'd say first of all, that most of the books that have influenced me are not what you would traditionally call business books.
Okay.
But there are a few that really do have had that effect. And one of them is The Bottom of the Pyramid by C.K. Prahlad. And primarily, because, it's all about coming up with new ways to look at sometimes age-old problems. And that is what that book does. It turns things upside down and tries to unravel some mysteries.
Interesting. So are they using, combining some type of frameworks in that particular book? Or certainly I'll have to read it.
Yeah.
But I want you to give me at least the Cliff Notes version.
See, when you think of, for instance, the unbanked, right? The problem of the unbanked is one in which you quite often have people in the rural areas in India, in China, as well as in the U.S., who do not participate in the financial sector.
Correct. Right?
And so when you're trying to resolve how do you address this bottom of the pyramid, you first have to motivate people on why is this so important for us to know. And that is the crux of what that book is about.
Okay. Very good. Great. Thank you. So, Scott, your thought?
I'd have to go with Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Mm.
I mean, there's so many great books out there, but that one, that just across the board, you see a lot of these the things he points out in there, you think they're so obvious, but then you read them and you say, gee, I could be a lot better at listening or remembering names or Making friends or building teams. I mean, he boils it all down to the simplest things, and it's impactful. I think it's a very well constructed book, and it's made a big difference for me.
Well, I appreciate that. So, gentlemen, on behalf of our learning community, it's been an honor again and a pleasure to have both of you join us today and share your thoughts and your wisdom and obviously your passion. And so I'd love to have you back on the show sometimes.
Absolutely.
Is that a deal?
Absolutely. Anytime.
Fantastic. So with that in mind, could each of you tell us how our learning community can contact you, either by email, address, or phone? Scott?
Sure. Scott Ellison. You can look me up. I'm at East West Manufacturing. The number there is 404-252-9441. And our website is EWMFG.com.
Fantastic. And your last name is not spelled E-L-L-I-S-O-N.
It's E-L-L-Y-S-O-N.
Fantastic.
That's right.
So thank you. Govind?
Govind Hariharan. You can contact me via the website, which is www.icainstitute.org. All of my contact information is there as well.
Very good. So with that response, we'll bring this edition of Global Leader Radio to a close. So we invite you to check our web presence for previous interviews and links to valuable leadership resources. And thank you to those who've actually dropped me an email about a recommendation for guests. I appreciate that. I'm looking forward to hearing from more of you. I am at acm0996@kennesaw.edu. So I invite you to join me next week at this same location for the next edition of Global Leader Radio, the show that discusses ideas that matter with people who care. Have a great week.
Global Leader Radio is brought to you by the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University. Take charge of your personal development and professional career today by learning more at KSUEMBA.com. And join us next week as we discuss ideas that matter with people who care.